Now, at 9:45 on Radio 4 Longwave and on digital radio, it's time for the Daily Service, led by the Reverend Dr. Mark Wakelin. Meanwhile, here on Radio 4 FM, we're beginning a new book of the week. Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon is the result of a decade of research and interviews in which the author seeks to discover how love is challenged when a child is radically different from his or her parents. The reader is Kerry Shale.
I walk in the rain by your side. I'll cling to the warmth of your tiny hand. I'll do anything to help you understand. I'll love you more than anybody can.
There is no such thing as reproduction. When two people decide to have a baby, they engage in an act of production. And the widespread use of the word reproduction for this activity, with its implication that two people are but braiding themselves together, is at best a euphemism to comfort prospective parents before they get in over their heads. In the subconscious fantasies that make conception look so alluring, it is often ourselves that we would like to see live forever, not someone with a personality of his own. Having anticipated the onward march of our selfish genes, many of us are unprepared for children who present unfamiliar needs. Parenthood abruptly catapults us into a permanent relationship with a stranger, and the more alien the stranger, the stronger the whiff of negativity. We depend on the guarantee in our children's faces that we will not die. Those children whose defining quality annihilates that fantasy of immortality are a particular insult. We must love them for themselves, and not for the best of ourselves in them. And that is a great deal harder to do. In 1993, I was assigned to investigate deaf culture for the New York Times. My assumption about deafness was that it was a deficit and nothing more. Over the months that followed, I found myself drawn into the deaf world. Most deaf children are born to hearing parents, who frequently prioritize functioning in the hearing world. While some deaf people are good at lip reading and produce comprehensible speech, many do not have that skill, and years go by as they sit with audiologists and speech pathologists instead of learning history and mathematics and philosophy. Many stumble upon deaf identity in adolescence, and it comes as a great liberation. They move into a world that validates sign as a language and discover themselves. Some hearing parents accept this powerful new development. Others struggle against it. The whole situation felt arrestingly familiar to me because I am gay. Gay people usually grow up under the purview of straight parents who feel that their children would be better off straight and sometimes torment them by pressing them to conform. Those gay people often discover gay identity in adolescence or afterwards, finding great relief there. When I started writing about the deaf, the cochlear implant, which can provide some facsimile of hearing, was a recent innovation. It had been hailed by its progenitors as a miraculous cure for a terrible defect and was deplored by the deaf as a genocidal attack on a vibrant community. Both sides have since moderated their rhetoric, but the issue is complicated by the fact that cochlear implants are most effective when they are surgically implanted early, in infants, ideally. So the decision is often made by parents before the child can possibly have or express an informed opinion. Watching the debate, I knew that my own parents would gamely have consented to a parallel early procedure to ensure that I would be straight had one existed. As my understanding of deaf culture deepened, I realized that the attitudes I had found benighted in my parents resembled my own likely response to producing a deaf child. My first impulse would have been to do whatever I could to fix the abnormality. Then, a friend had a daughter who was a dwarf. She wondered whether she should bring up her daughter to consider herself just like everyone else, only shorter, whether she should make sure her daughter had dwarf role models, or whether she should investigate surgical limb lengthening. As she narrated her bafflement, I saw a familiar pattern. I had been startled to note my common ground with the deaf, and now I was identifying with a dwarf. I wondered who else was out there, waiting to join our gladsome throng. I thought that if gayness, an identity, could grow out of homosexuality, an illness, and deafness, an identity, could grow out of deafness, an illness, and if dwarfism, as an identity, could emerge from an apparent disability, then there must be many other categories in this awkward interstitial territory. It was a radicalizing insight. Having always imagined myself in a fairly slim minority, I suddenly saw that I was in a vast company. Difference unites us. While each of these experiences can isolate those who are affected, together they compose an aggregate of millions whose struggles connect them profoundly. Because of the transmission of identity from one generation to the next, most children share at least some traits with their parents. These are vertical identities. Ethnicity, for example. Children of color are in general born to parents of color. Language, too, is usually vertical, since most people who speak Greek raise their children to speak Greek. Often, however, someone has an inherent or acquired trait that is foreign to his or her parents, and must therefore acquire identity from a peer group. This is a horizontal identity. Such horizontal identities may reflect recessive genes, random mutations, prenatal influences, or values and preferences that a child does not share with his progenitors. Being gay is a horizontal identity. Most gay kids are born to straight parents. And while their sexuality is not determined by their peers, they learn gay identity by observing and participating in a subculture outside the family. The time-worn adage says that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, meaning that a child resembles his or her parents. The children I describe here are apples that have fallen elsewhere, some a couple of orchards away, some on the other side of the world. Yet myriad families learn to tolerate, accept, and finally celebrate children who are not what they originally had in mind. I had dyslexia as a child. Indeed, I have it now. I still cannot write by hand without focusing on each letter as I form it. And even when I do so, some letters are out of order or omitted. My mother, who identified the dyslexia early, began to work on reading with me when I was 2. I spent long afternoons in her lap, learning to sound out words. When I was 6, my parents applied for my admission to 11 schools in New York City, and all 11 turned me down on the grounds that I would never learn to read and write. A year later, I was enrolled in a school where the principal grudgingly allowed my advanced reading skills to overrule test scores that predicted I would never learn to read at all. With patience, love, intelligence, and will, we had trounced a neurological abnormality. Unfortunately, it set the stage for our later struggles by making it hard to believe that we couldn't reverse the creeping evidence of another perceived abnormality, my being gay. Because I could tell early on that many of my impulses were unmasculine, I embarked on further acts of self-invention. When, in first grade, each of us was asked to name his favorite food, and everyone else said ice cream, or hamburgers, or French toast, I proudly chose Ekmek Kadayef with Kaymak, which I used to order at an Armenian restaurant on East 27th Street. I never traded a baseball card, but I did recount the plots of operas on the school bus. None of this made me popular. I was popular at home, but I was subject to corrections. My mother, my brother, and I were at a shoe store when I was 7, and as we were leaving, the salesman asked what color balloons we'd like. My brother wanted a red balloon. I wanted a pink one. My mother countered that I didn't want a pink balloon and reminded me that my favorite color was blue. I said I really wanted the pink, but under her glare, I took the blue one. That my favorite color is blue, but I'm still gay, is evidence of both my mother's influence and its limits. My mother didn't want me to be gay because she thought it wouldn't be the happiest course for me, but equally, she didn't like the image of herself as the mother of a gay son. The problem wasn't that she wanted to control my life, although she did, like most parents, genuinely believe that her way of being happy was the best way of being happy. The problem was that she wanted to control her life, and it was her life as the mother of a homosexual that she wished to alter. Unfortunately, there was no way for her to fix her problem without involving me. When I was growing up, we nonetheless had close family friends who were gay, neighbors and surrogate great uncles to my brother and me, who spent holidays with us because their own families would not have them. I was always bewildered that Elmer had gone off to fight in World War II halfway through medical school, and then opened a gift shop when he came home. For years, I heard that the terrible things he saw in the war had changed him, and that he didn't have the stomach for medicine after his return. It was only after Elmer died that Willie, his partner of 50 years, explained to me that no one would have considered going to an openly gay doctor in 1945. The horrors of war had propelled Elmer into integrity, and he paid its price by spending his adulthood painting amusing bar stools and selling crockery. Elmer and Willie were a great romance in many ways, but an undertone of sadness for what might have been informed their lives. The gift shop was an apology for medicine. Christmas with us was an apology for family. I am humbled by Elmer's choice. I do not know that I would have had the courage to choose likewise, nor the discipline to keep regret from undermining my love had I done so. Though Elmer and Willie would never have seen themselves as activists, their galvanizing sorrow and that of others like them was the precondition of my happiness and that of others like me. When I understood their story more richly, I recognized that my parents' fears for me were not simply the product of overactive imaginations. It's terrifying to me to think that without my mother's sustained intervention, I might never have learned fluency in letters. I am grateful every day for the sufficient resolution of my dyslexia. Conversely, while I might have had an easier life if I had been straight, I am now wedded to the idea that without my struggles, I would not be myself, and that I like being myself better than I like the idea of being someone else. Someone I have neither the ability to imagine nor the option of being.
Kerry Shale was reading the first extract from Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for Radio 4. Part 2, tomorrow at the same time.
You can't be impartial between the fire and the fireman, so said Winston Churchill of the BBC during the first battle for the airwaves over the general strike of 1926. Whose side are you on is a question politicians have asked again and again over the decades as they've accused broadcasters of siding not just with strikers but also with terrorists and the establishment, with Colonel Nasser, General Galtieri and Saddam Hussein. Battle for the Airwaves with me, Nick Robinson, tells the stories of those power struggles. It starts today at 1:45 on BBC Radio 4.